Welcome. This is the 13th lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Art in Taiwan. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, who will speak to us on the topic of women's soteriological agency, text transmission and Buddhist institutions. Bhikkhuni Dhammadina studied Indology, Indo-Iranian philology, and Tibetology at the University of Naples, La Orientale, and at the International Research Institute for Advanced Buddhology at Soka University in Tokyo. Bhikkhuni Dhammadina obtained her MA in 2004 with a study on the formation of the Tibetan Burn Canon, focusing on a Burnpo adaptation of a Mahayana Sutra on the basis of Dzogchen teachings. She received her PhD in 2010 with a dissertation on the early transmission of Bodhisattva and Mahayana ideology in Khotan. Her research focuses on the early Buddhist discourses, the historical development of Buddhist meditative transmission traditions in India, and monastic law based on comparative study of Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chinese, and Khotanese texts. She is currently a research associate professor and the director of the Agama Research Group in the Department of Buddhist Studies at the Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Arts in Taiwan. And with that much of introduction, I now hand over to Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. No, you don't have to disappear, Dhammadina. You can stay, you know? Anyway, this is time now to wrap this course and also the other two courses of last year. Just one second, Venerable Dhammadina, you can switch on your camera, but if you can switch it off the microphone, otherwise we have this echo. Switch off the yeah, and you can switch on the camera so we can see you if you like. So this is the end of altogether. Well, there's still a question. I don't know if you want to answer that, Venerable Dhammadina. There's a question by Peter Kieferpuls. And you have to switch on your mic again. Good, then it's time to wrap up. So switch off your mic. So this is the end of this year's course and also this whole series of three courses over 3 years that started on, we got started with this gender colloquium 4 years ago. And at that time, I had this idea of doing one e-learning course, and we founded this Women in Buddhism Study Initiative with Venerable Lekshet Somo, Petra Kieferpuls, and Lisa Fancott. And so we got started on this first course on Bhikkhuni ordination. And since this went so well, I decided to continue. And I must specifically express my gratitude to Petra. She gave me a lot of support during the second course, where we were branching out from the topic of Bhikkhunis to women in India. And I must specifically express my gratitude to Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, who has already disappeared. I hope she would stay with me visually while I'm giving my last part, because she has been giving me a lot of support during this third course. And I personally feel that effort and time we all invested in this course has really brought a lot of fruit. It has been very stimulating and entertaining and interesting. And I would like to thank all of the lecturers all these 3 years for offering their courses free of any kind of charge, for all of the students for their interesting comments and questions. And I would specifically like to also express my gratitude to Jampat Sedran. She does a lot of organization, and that doesn't leave her so much time to do research work. But I mean, for myself, the organization effort she put into the 2007 conference on Bhikkhuni ordination has been crucial to make me aware of the need that there's some work to be done, and this is basically the starting point for me getting really seriously interested in working on this topic of women in Buddhism. And she was also the one who organized this gender colloquium 4 years ago, which then gave on the spark to have this 3 year series. So in sum, my gratitude, my rejoicing, and yes, thanks to all of you. Bye.
Can you hear me any better now?
And it is perfect now.
Ah, okay, great. Fine. So I continue with the display of youthful bodies. After the funeral, the Buddha relates an avadana. So there is a story of a past life of Gautami. So there is a connection between this feature of the nuns, the youthful bodies. The Tibetan version says they have no wrinkles. This detail is not found in the Chinese version, but in any case, in both versions, they are youthful and virginal bodies. And her merits, her meritorious actions in past lives. So in Indian Buddhist context, there is always a connection between virtue and results. Of course, this is obvious, but one of the results of virtue can be physical beauty, or lack of disease and so on. In this particular case, after in the avadana, in the story of the past life of Gautami, in one of the past lives of Gautami, Gautami and her followers, at the time of Buddha Kashyapa, had been the chief queens of a king. She was the chief queen of a king, and the 500 nuns were the royal concubines of this king. They were neglected by the king when they became old, so at that point they wished they could have life after life, youthful bodies, until the end of their lives, so that they would not be discarded again by the king when becoming old. So they make a meritorious action to a stupa, and there is an aspiration that they make that they may have for the remainder of their samsaric existence always youthful bodies until the end of their lives, and they make the wish that this may happen throughout their future lives. So the opening the rope of Gautami perhaps can be read in connection with the eldest son cutting the shroud of the deceased person, whereas the content of this display, that is to say these useful bodies, can be read in terms of the avadana didactics of this storytelling, of these merits making narratives and using narratives to promote virtue, to promote dana, to promote generosity and so on. So again, this puts this strange passage, somehow strange passage, into context. To sum up, so the funerary proceedings are presented as the monks' respectful tribute to Gautami and the nuns, and they are formally carried out in accordance with the conventions of the time, and the record memorializes the founder of the Bhikshuni Sangha and their Arati nun followers, and the core value is Parinirvana, and as far as the Avadana story is concerned, is merit. So as far as the audience is concerned, merit comes in at this point in addition to Parinirvana. This brings me to case study number 3, where instead of such a positive attitude to the nuns within the Parinirvana, we have a not so positive voice of the transmitters. So Dashi is a Chinese Vinaya master, and he's written a number of Vinaya commentaries, and in one of his Vinaya commentaries he quotes the Sutra of the Mahaparinirvana of the Buddha's mother. This text is one of the most misogynist and sad actually versions of the Parinirvana of the Buddha's mother. And it is quoted by Dao Shi in the context of his commentary. And of course, by quoting it, he is reactualizing it within the boundaries of the commentary. So what does this text say? The text says that after the funerary homage and the cremation, Mahaprajapati's relics are brought to the Buddha. The Buddha declares that his mother and her followers have been freed from their dirty female bodies, their dirty bodies, which are full of negative emotions, and they are now able to act as men, which will lead to a hardship. And then the Buddha orders a temple to be built. So this is a little bit strange, that there is a soteriological and textual inconsistency here, since there is a further rebirth for an arahant meant. So the arahi Mahaprajapati is shown as if now she's finally able to gain, gain a body and a male body, finally free from impurities. And so this, of course, contradicts the very fact that Dao Shi and the Sutra of the Mahaparinirvana, the Buddha's mother, are recounting the account, the story of Mahaprajapati's final nirvana, final liberation. And it's very clear that the texts are framing this passage in terms of arahantship, so there is no extra construction wherein Gautami could, for example, be perceived as a bodhisattva in, you know, under disguise and so on. So there clearly is a textual inconsistency, and this textual inconsistency has to do with the idea that females must be born as males to attain the final goal, a final goal which they have anyway already attained. And this is explained in the light of the wide circulation in China and probably also in medieval India, of the idea that bodhisattva investiture needs a male body. So due to the influence of this idea that that a male body is necessary for the final goal meant as bodhisattvahood and thereby Buddhahood, there is a sort of back reading into this Mahaparinirvana episode in 7th century China, where the Mahayana is basically everywhere, where Mahayana ideology is basically everywhere, as if Mahaprajapati also needs a male body in her Parinirvana state, which of course does not exist. So here we have a negative attitude of the transmitters, an attitude bias with a new gender construct of female soteriology. But there is also a factual record, an objective factual record, so there is no denying that the Buddha is having a temple built for his mother, so there is no denial of the memorialization of Gautami and of her achievement. And this ideology of needing a male body and of the female body being impure has already been discussed in previous lectures, and is anyway it's an ideological construct which is still very alive in the contemporary Chinese Buddhist tradition. Crane has written a PhD thesis on the ideology of masculinization in Chinese Buddhist monasticism, which is very much in line with this whole commentarial trend based on the requirement of a male body for bodhisattvahood and Buddhahood. This now finally brings me to, again, a positive case of reciter's attitude to their texts, and this is the story of a woman who cooks for the Buddha in the Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. This is a narrative excursus, so a narrative story within a story, so it's a story within a Vinaya story, it's a story within a Vinaya narrative that is unique to the Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya tradition. Other Vinaya traditions, they share the same background narrative, but they don't have such a story. So this story is found in the Vinaya narrative that tells how once the Buddha and his monks were not fed enough during the rains, during their residence in the rainy season. And not only the Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada tradition, but also other traditions, they relate this starvation of the Buddha and the Sangha to some bad karma committed by the Buddha in the past. And this reflects a growing intention on the Buddha's bad karma as also an inspirational, actually, platform wherein, by stating that the Buddha and the Arahants or the eminent disciples also had bad karma, also had questionable pasts, they became who they were, who they became. So this is actually meant as inspirational to the audience. So one needs not to worry too much about one's bad karma, and there is always a chance to improve and to recondition the bad karma. So the bad karma of the Buddha can perform an inspirational function. However, in these two, all in these two versions, Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada, Vinaya versions, there is a connection between a woman's act of service to the Buddha and the Sangha and the formulation of a spiritual aspiration. And this episode, as I said, is incidental. It is an aside. It's a story within a story to the main narrative. And for this reason, it's particularly informative. It's particularly relevant, since there is no doctrinal or scholastic statement intentionally made, but there is more a reflection of how this text was relating to women's aspirations, to the women's path, and so on. So here is the version in Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. The Blessed One said this to the Venerable Ananda. This is after the woman has cooked some horse fodder barley for the Sangha and has offered it to Ananda, and Ananda has brought it to the Buddha. So this is the meritorious action that has been performed by this woman. So the Blessed One said this to the Venerable Ananda. Why, Ananda, did you not provide a description of the Buddha's qualities to that girl? And Ananda said, Venerable Sir, this occurs to me. The characteristics of a Buddha are profound, and it could have been the case that that girl would have not have grasped them. Therefore, I provided a description of a will-turning king's qualities for her. And the Buddha said, you are at fault, Ananda. Had you provided a description of the Buddha's qualities for her, it could be the case that she would have generated an irreversible intention toward unsurpassed full awakening. Nevertheless, Ananda, that girl will become the woman treasure or will-turning king. So here we have the Buddha, so to say, rebuking basically correcting Ananda for not having inspired this young woman by expounding to her the qualities of the Buddha, which are necessary for anyone to formulate an aspiration to become a Buddha himself or herself. So Ananda didn't do that. Why? Because he thought that these qualities were too deep, and the woman would not have been able to grasp them. And the Buddha doesn't agree. He doesn't think that the woman would have not been able to grasp them. So what does this mean? This means that the Buddha is telling Ananda that she's made a mistake. In Sanskrit, shunastvama Ananda. So you are at fault, Ananda. And in the Tibetan parlance, kungavo chogi malepa shichate, Ananda, it's not well done by you. And in Chinese, it's anan, ru wei bo shi, Ananda, you made a mistake. So it's very clear, Ananda is at fault. And why is he at fault? He is at fault because he has not been able to recognize the potential of this woman. So actually there is a clear statement on the part of the Buddha that this woman had the potential to formulate an aspiration to Buddhahood. And it is quite interesting, given that this is a Vinaya text, and in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, in its section on the that contains the account of the foundation of the nuns order, has rather strong words for. Of course, it doesn't deny the soteriological capabilities of women, but at the same time, you know, as all other versions, has rather strong words that have come into the text. and they are not complementary of women. And in the same La Sravasiva tradition, in the account of the first communal recitation of the Buddha's teachings, the Sanghiti, Ananda is also on record for having been criticized by Mahakashyapa for being too friendly to women. So it's actually quite interesting that in this case the Vinaya is able to preserve this reading by having, for a change, Ananda, who has not been able to recognize, who is so keen on women and so, such a supportive presence in the history of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, however, he has not been able to recognize the potential of this woman here. So the failure and the admonition of the Buddha highlights, by contrast, the woman's potential. I think I'm going on for another perhaps 20 minutes, if you don't mind. Okay, and so this case is quite interesting. So there is a failure, but there is also success at the same time, and the success is the recognition of the potential of this woman. As I already said, the Mulasravastivada Vinaya presents a missed opportunity to aspire to the Bodhisattva path, and had Ananda been capable of fully assisting the spiritual flourishing of the woman cook, she would have presumably generated a resolve towards Buddhahood. So the transmitters of this Vinaya, they were at home with the idea that a woman can aspire to Buddhahood. They were at ease with this idea, and they didn't have any qualms with this idea. So this is an example of a Vinaya text embodying a rather positive attitude on the part of male monastic transmitters, on the part of this third-person perspective of the male monastic transmitters that I have introduced at the beginning of the talk. And, what does this mean? This basically means that a Vinaya canonical text, however transmitted within an inherently androcentric institution, such as the Buddhist Sangha, had nothing to object to a woman's aspiration to Buddhahood. And so this is what it could be called an affirmative statement, or what in employment contract there is this affirmative action wherein one wants to employ women and wants to encourage diversity. So this is an affirmative statement. I don't want to call it affirmative action, but it is for sure an affirmative statement on the part of the Buddha. And what I have to say, coming into the domain of religious history, that in view of the negative effects that gender biases can have on women's representation of their own agency, actually the Buddha's admonition to Ananda is quite poignant, because basically the Buddha is pointing to the fact that it is a failure and a fault not to be able to serve a woman's spiritual interest, not to be able to put oneself at the service of a woman's spiritual journey. And this has also been highlighted by Dancho Finnegan in her PhD thesis. She also focused on this passage, not on the whole narrative, but on this passage. And she has a very nice way of calling the Buddha's perfect ethical agency. So the Buddha is the perfect moral agent who is able to take into account all the particulars of reality, including the woman's mental inclinations. And of course, Ananda does not have this knowledge of the Buddha, who is also increasingly perceived as all-knowing and omniscient in the text, so he's not able to fathom the depths of this woman's mind qualities. In the Sarvastivada Vinaya, we have a parallel to this story. I think this is a little bit too long now to be dealt with in full, so I will just summarize it. In the Sarvastivada Vinaya, there is again a woman who is able to cook, who offers to to cook for the Buddha, and she actually volunteers to cook for the Buddha after she's heard a praise of the Buddha's qualities. So in this case, there has been an exposition of the Buddha's qualities, but this has been made to a first woman who didn't agree to cook. So the second woman has overheard this exposition and has come forward to cook for the Buddha. I will just go directly to the same passage that I have reported. I focused on for the Mulatravastivada version. That is to say, the Buddha commenting to Ananda with regard to the woman's meritorious act and the woman's spiritual potential. So this is the third paragraph in this slide. The Buddha told Ananda, the one who did not cook will not be able to get what she could have obtained. Had she been the one who had cooked, she would have become the chief consort of the wheel-turning king. The one who cooked out of her own initiative gained such an immeasurable merit. Suppose she does not make any additional merit, such virtue is so vast that it would alone lead her as far as liberation. So again, the Buddha is making an affirmative statement as regards women's soteriological potential. However, this last sentence, such virtue is so vast that it would alone lead her as far as liberation, this is my rendering of the Chinese text, has some textual difficulties. And I selected this particular text not only to bring home the point that Vinayas are not all about misogyny, but also to highlight that there is a lot of textual and philological complexity when dealing with this kind of text. So this means that we need to be extremely careful to draw any conclusion, be it on gender relevance or anything else, when dealing with texts that had a complex philological history and in many cases had several variant readings. So this is where it's extremely important that any religio-historical assessment of this text is made on this is made to rest on the solid foundation of philological studies. So coming to this last sentence, I want to very quickly show the type of philological complexity that can be involved when dealing with this kind of text. So there is a textual difficulty. Why? I render this string as such virtue is so vast that it would alone lead her as far as liberation. So difficulty number one, we have a variant reading in one of the edition in a manuscript edition of the Chinese canon and its copies, wherein this second part of the string, this second clause, as far as liberation, is omitted. So if this variant reading is original in the text, it belongs to the original formation of this text, we have no special soteriological slant to the acknowledgement of the virtue of the woman, but there is just an acknowledgement of the virtues as such. So such virtue is so vast. Such a virtue is very vast. There is no statement in terms of where to these virtues are leading. And in this case, we would not know how this merit is going to evolve, how this merit is going to be translated into further development. So this is the first difficulty. The second difficulty, there are more than two actually, so I selected two or three, I can't remember. Two or three, I think three, yes. So the second difficulty is that even on accepting the variant reading that includes the string up to liberation, so there is a vast merit that is able to lead up to liberation, which is actually the variant reading found in most editions with the exception of this single manuscript edition and its copies. Even then, we don't really know what up to Nai Zhi in Chinese translates. It can be used as an abbreviation. So in this case, we are like in Sanskrit, yavat, which means such virtue is so vast, up to liberation. And in within this up to, we need to supplement various merits, various intermediate stages of merit that will culminate eventually in liberation. So in this case, this woman gains a range of benefits encapsulated by the abbreviation. In case Naiju is not used as an abbreviation, we are more or less the same meaning. The text is simply saying such virtue is so vast so as to lead her up to liberation. So there is no intermediate range of merits involved, but there is a straight path all the way to liberation. Difficulty number three, and apologies for this typo in the PowerPoint, there is, and this difficulty is actually the most crucial one, is a possible semantic ambivalence of the word liberation, jietuo, in Chinese. So this term, this Chinese term, usually translates liberation, vimuti or vimukti, and liberation stands for arahatship in this context. When we search for comparable usages of this cluster and of this term liberation in the Sarvastivada Vinaya, we don't find I couldn't find any comparable context that would be able to throw light on this passage, on how this passage uses this terminology, or perhaps how the translator of the Sarvastivada Vinaya uses this type of terminology. However, from a text historical and religious historical perspective, the Sarvastivada storyline is really in aligned with stories of arahats to be and arahats, so female arahats to be, that are found elsewhere, not only in Sarvastivada, Mula Sarvastivada, middle period narratives, but also elsewhere. So from context and also from a linguistic point of view, a plain reading in terms of arahanship would be neither unusual nor unexpected. So this is not a problem, and perhaps it can be assumed that we can rely on a plain reading of the text. But if we move on to the commentarial layer, we have a Vinaya commentary on the Sarvastivada Vinaya, which is presently extant only in Chinese translation. And Vibhasha means commentary, so this is the Vibhasha on the Sarvastivada Vinaya. And as all commentaries do, they gloss on certain key terms in the canonical text, and they at times explain the grammatical usage, at times they cross-reference. Actually, Petra Kifferfuss is here in the audience tonight, and she is the scholar of Pali commentaries in Buddhist studies. So you can actually refer to her studies of Pali commentaries to see how they work. In this particular case, the Sarvastivada Vinaya commentary is proposing a specific reading of liberation, of jietuo, we have in the canonical text. What does the Chinese commentary say? It says, had she cooked the grains, she is the woman, she would have become the woman treasure of a wheel-turning king at the time of the Buddha Maitreya. The one who personally cooked the grains gained immeasurable merit, so that, with that as a condition, she will surely reach unsurpassed full awakening. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. So here, the Vinaya commentary is reading liberation through the lenses of the Bodhisattva path. In that, full awakening means to become a Buddha, and if you aim at Buddhahood, means you are a Bodhisattva, you are on the Bodhisattva path. So what to make of this reading? We need to bear in mind that this particular Vinaya commentary, not extant in Sanskrit, we don't have any single Sanskrit fragment or quotation of this Vipassana, as far as I know, has been shown by Funayama Toru in Kyoto University to have incorporated Chinese elements in its text. So Funayama says, from Chinese elements incorporated in the body of the text, it's possible to conclude that Sarvastivada Vinaya Vibhasha is a mixture of translation of an Indic text, which constitutes the greater part, and a certain amount of exegetical elements that were interpolated, perhaps, in the process of transcribing the translation. So this is actually quite common process. In China, there was translation, sometimes oral translation, sometimes translation based on manuscripts, and there was oral lecturing and oral commenting on the texts that were being either translated or simply preached or expounded. So sometimes these oral lectures by the Chinese masters ended up incorporated within the original texts themselves. So that it's no longer possible to differentiate what was in the original Indic text as it came to China and what was added on the basis of the audience dimension, I mean of the oral dimension, of the oral and aural usage of this text. In any case, although the story presupposed the Vinaya commentary reading reads the text from the perspective of the Bodhisattva past, we need not to assume that when the original Indian text was formed, it was actually inclusive of the Bodhisattva past. As I said, there is strong structural and typological affinity with stories of merit-making of future arhats and future arhatis in the Avadhanashataka and other texts which actually belong to the same textual horizon of the Mula Sarvastivada and Sarvastivada Vinayas, broadly speaking. So we can explain the probably Chinese idea of Bodhisattvahood and Buddhahood in the light of the prevalence of Mahayana ideology at the time of the reduction of the Vibhasha. This does not pose any problem. But what is, in my opinion, extremely interesting is that although Mahayana soteriology, of course, sees severe limitations in female gender in terms of attaining the confirmed level of Bodhisattvahood, at the same time, the Vinaya commentary was so enthusiastic and was so influenced by Mahayana ideas, so to say, seeing the Bodhisattva path in all kinds of texts, that it didn't have any issue with applying the reading of Bodhisattvahood onto this text, even though the protagonist was a woman. So we have at one time a textual development, or at least an exegetical development, wherein the commentary reads a text through the lenses of the Bodhisattva path, and at the same time, this ideological and soteriological mainstreaming of Mahayana ideology in China, and not only in China, is so powerful that somehow overrides the tendency to downgrade, so to say, female soteriological agency along the Bodhisattva path. So, in sum, what can we say in terms of women's soteriological agency and canonical text transmitters and commentarial text transmitters? That pending the existence of textual uncertainties in the canonical text, the monastic commentators who produced the Vibhasha on the Sarvastivada Vinaya clearly read the story along the lines of Buddhahood. Not worthy in view of the effect of tendencies to soteriological exclusion that were to affect the fully formed formulation of the Bodhisattva path in Indian Buddhism and beyond Indian Buddhism. And this goes to show that the monks who transmitted these canonical texts and the commentary, which is a separate thing, they were not only willing to acknowledge a woman's spiritual standing in terms of her great merit, that eventually is going to ripen in liberation, as we have seen in Sarvastivada Vinaya, but they even go as far as perceiving a woman's aspiration to Buddhahood as an acceptable proposition, as per the Buddha's corrective of Ananda, who the Buddha who declares that the woman would have been able to aspire to Buddhahood. So this again gives us a sense of textual, historical development and ideological influence of text transmitters and how these texts were continuously recontextualized during the history of their transmission. So we have seen, idea that the parinirvana of Gautami is only leading to a fortunate male birth free forever or from the dirty, polluted female body. So in one Vinaya commentary, and then in this other Vinaya commentary, we have a very positive gloss. So again and again, scholarship is becoming aware of this dimension of multivocality in terms of gender perspectives in early and medieval Buddhist texts. So this is actually the main point that these varied voices and varied perspectives flow into relief. And I have a final topic, since I've already gone overboard with my time, I may as well keep you here for this last topic. I will try to be a little bit quick, but this is particularly important because this is actually my main point is that there is not only this multi perspective on text, but there is also like a multi dimensional perspective in the actual life of this text within Buddhist communities and Buddhist institutions down to this day. So we will see the same multi-dimensionality in an institutional my last case study, which is an institutional, exquisitely institutional case study. Okay, let me put water. So this last case study has to do with Gautami's Upasampada. So we go back to the foundation of the nuns order. We have seen the final parinirvana of Gautami and her 500 nuns, and now we go back to the beginnings of the foundation of the nuns order. Here we have in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, which I chose to take as my main textual point of reference for this lecture, without of course basing myself only on the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, but trying to present a consistent picture from within the Mula Sarvastivada textual tradition, and I feel this is also methodologically important in that we need to have historical comparative attitude to all Vinayas, but it's also important to be able to reason even historically from within the platform of a single Vinaya. So now I'm talking from within the boundaries of the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya specifically, with an awareness of the other Vinayas. So Maha Prajapati Gautami Supasampada took place by her agreement to lifelong observance of this bedeviled eight Guru Dharmas or Garudhammas in Pali. I don't even need to say what they are, because we all know what they are. And they have been often brought into even contemporary discussions of female Buddhist monasticism. However bedeviled and controversial these Guru Dharmas may be, they still represent the core of the foundation narrative of the ninth order. Given that from a legal point of view, Prajapati Gautami's Upasampada took place by her acceptance of the Guru Dharmas, which sanctioned her full admission into the Buddhist order, these Guru Dharmas, this cluster of rules and their ideology, you know, their whole hierarchical package, they represent the legal etiology and the ideological etiology for the establishment of the female monastic order. So most of these Guru Dharmas, they regulate communal transactions between the order of nuns and the order of monks, and they regulate, not all of them, but most of them, they regulate the relationship between individual nuns and individual monks, and nuns as a group vis-à-vis monks as a group. So there is a very clear and clearly spelled out the hierarchical subordination, which is institutional subordination rather than a soteriological subordination, for example. And at the same time, the monks are responsible to provide exhortation, training, and protection. Of course, to speak of protection or exhortation may sound very patronizing towards the nuns, as if they needed to be, you know, fathered or trained by the monks. But we need to understand that the nuns' sangha came into being after the monks' sangha. So in any case, from a legal perspective, the legal lineage comes from the monks' sangha, and also the monks had the know-how, had the skills of monastic life that the newly formed nuns' sangha didn't have. Of course, I really cannot go into this now, and Venerable Anario has just published a few months ago a book on the foundation history of the nuns' order, so he goes into great detail on the significance of these Guru Dharmas and how they evolved over time. In any case, the main point I want to make is that the Vinaya hierarchical subordination is essentially gender-based, and it comes combined with the anteriority and thereby the seniority of the monks' community as a whole. But in any case, the main point of hierarchization is gender-based, and this is how the Vinaya is structured. And how Ma Prajapati Gautami's acceptance of the Guru Dharmas has set a legal antecedent for all subsequent Buddhist nuns to be legally conditioned and legally related to this hierarchization and subordination. So in the Vinaya, we have different kinds of ordination. Some kinds of ordinations are listed in Vinaya lists as being legally fit to stand, and some types of ordination, they are listed as not being fit to stand. What does this mean? This means that the institutional history of the early Buddhist Sangha went through stages of institutional development. So later forms of ordination substituted earlier forms of ordination. So since nuns' ordination was no longer performed at the time of the closure of the Vinaya, was no longer performed by the acceptance of the Guru Dharmas, which is in fact a peculiarity of this very first ordination, Upasampada, higher ordination by the Guru Dharmas, is no longer applicable, has no direct legal application or applicability. However, most of the 8 Guru Dharmas are included in the nuns Vibhangas. The Vibhangas are the exposition of the rules connected to origin narratives, and therein they are also included in the Pratimokshas or Patimokkha in Pali, in the summary of the rules that are recited every fortnight. So since the Guru Dharmas are included in the Vibhangas and in the Pratimokshas, they are effective Vinaya. Of course, they are effectively Vinaya in any case, since they are part of the foundation narrative itself, as I just mentioned. But what I want to say is that they really have a critical significance, not only in ideological terms, but also in legal terms, because they start off the whole Nansanga. And in fact, the Buddhist tradition, in terms of manuscript history and also structural arrangement of the Vinaya texts, there are many texts that compose the Vinaya, has highlighted the foundational importance and significance of these Guru Dharmas by excerpting them from the foundation narrative, of course, along with the foundation narrative, but as a head of the Vinaya, and in the case of, for example, of the Mahasanghika Lokottaravada in Dikshuni Vinaya, as was already mentioned last year by Annie Langenberg, they have been, and it's already been pointed out by Gustav Roth, who has edited the Mahasanghika Lokottaravada in Dikshuni Vinaya, they were placed at the beginning of the whole Dikshuni Vinaya, thereby really giving the institutional and ideological flavor to the whole Vinaya unfolding. And why? Because they represent the etiology, the history of the foundation, so they give authenticity to the whole nuns' lineage. And even other Vinayas outside the Mahasanghika Lokottaravada in Vinaya, which has no continuity to this day, even in other Vinayas which do have a continuing tradition, there is a structural prominence given to these Guru Dharmas. For example, in the Theravada Vinaya, they are placed in the Chulavaga, and the Chulavaga is one of the khandakas of the Theravada Vinaya, which really contains the very foundational historical materials of the history of the Buddhist Sangha. So again, the foundational and history account making role is emphasized. And as regards the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, which is the Vinaya, the Indian Vinaya that is still practiced by the living Tibetan tradition, the Guru Dharma complex and the foundation history is played in the Kshudraka Vastu, which is similarly concerned not only but also with foundational material. On the other hand, the Dharmagupta Vinaya, which is a Vinaya that is presently used by the Chinese tradition, does not give any special place to these Guru Dharmas. So what happened with this bedeviled narrative, this Guru Dharma cluster? With mass communication and with digital age, philological studies and the text historical method have made their impact outside academia, precisely like this course, actually, which has not only academic participants and students of academic institutions, but also non-academic participants. And so more or less correct dissemination of academic findings on the alleged non-historicity of the Guru Dharmas has been the basis for a progressive or a liberal rejection of the validity of the Guru Dharmas and of their legally binding nature. However, this has taken place on the basis of a decontextualization, so on the basis of a lack of positioning of these Guru Dharmas in their legally binding context and in their historical genesis. And this kind of discourse is alien, actually, to the legal and intellectual history of the Buddhist tradition and of and its scholasticism. So hereby, of course, I'm not taking a position, a judgmental position, that this discourse is wrong or right, but what I want to point out is that this discourse, this progressive discourse, is in turn based on a progressive ideology, which is not the same ideology that is reflected by the structure, by the legal structure of the Vinaya. So there is an ideological clash here of ideological frameworks. And indeed, the liberal approach to the letter of the Vinaya is against its spirit has been used to suggest the removal or even the non-application or non-applicability, which are two different things, non-application or non-applicability, they are a different discourse, not to apply it, but to recognize it. Would be one thing. I mean, there are many rules in Buddhist monasticism which are not applied, but they are not questioned. And non-applicability means that they are their legal status is erased or is rejected. And so this liberal approach has been used to suggest the removal or non-application applicability of the Buddha Dharmas on the grounds of their conflict with the mainstream notion of gender equality as a universal human right. And of course, the gender discrimination is part of the Buddhist tradition, but and this is not the same as gender inequality or equality. So equality and inequality and discrimination are not exactly the same discourse. But what is ironic is that even though I will skip this, but what I want to say is that it's really ironic, because although the Guru Dharmas they are seen as principles of institutional subordination and they do express hierarchization. So they are oppressive, so to say, of women. At the same time, one of the Guru Dharmas has been able to afford a legally legitimate base for the contemporary revival of the Bhikkhuni Sangha in the Theravada tradition. So a discriminative or discrimination-based rule or legal principle has actually been able to enable the reopening of the doors to lawful, so Vinaya-compliant, female renunciation in the Theravada Sangha. And this has allowed the reestablishment of the Bhikkhuni Sangha to stand on firm legal grounds, legal grounds that are accepted even by Theravada traditionalists, who would not be open to accepting a form of re-establishment of the Bhikkhuni Sangha on the basis of, say, gender equality or gender mainstreaming or reopening the doors of the Sangha on the basis of this kind of values. So this is somehow ironic. There is a irony, because the Guru Dharmas, they feature in the foundation history, and they feature also in the refoundation history. And the one Guru Dharma in question is Garuda Dharma number 6 in the Theravada Vinaya, which allows monks to ordain nuns when there is no Bhikkhuni Sangha in existence, or else when the Bhikkhuni Sangha has become extinct, as Venerable Analayo has shown. So this is explained in view of the fact that the ultimate legal authority in the Vinaya rests with the Bhikkhu Sangha. And so this provision of Guru Dhamma, Garuda Dhamma number 6, has allowed for this re-establishment of the Bhikkhuni Sangha on a legally firm ground. Of course, there have been previous attempts of re-establishment, but they have not been accepted by legal traditionalists, whereas this attempt is Vinaya-proof, so to say, since it is explainable and justifiable by exploiting a legal principle that is already embedded in the Pali Vinaya itself. And, strange enough, the same irony and the same paradox obtains in the case of the Tibetan and the Himalayan traditions, which are the modern-day heirs of the traditional Indian Mula Sarvastivada lineage, since it has been shown by Bhikshuni Champa Cedron and Venerable Analayo, the exploitation of one of the Guru Dharmas, or else the exploitation of the legal implications of one of the Guru Dharmas in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, might be able to solve the legal controversy in the for the establishment of the Tibetan Mula Sarvastivada tradition in a way which can be deemed acceptable by traditional conservative Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya masters, much in the same way as the exploitation of Garuda Dhamma 6 in the case of the Pali Vinaya, has been considered acceptable on legal grounds by Theravada Vinaya scholars. So this is interesting because somehow the multi-dimension and multi-layering and even, so to say, cognitive dissonance that sometimes as modern readers we may experience when approaching this text is also showing that the whole historical and institutional process as based on the text is actually regulated by principles which really need to be contextualized. And this is, I think, one of the most important points collectively the lecturers in this course have made. And this brings me to my conclusion, and this is the paradox of subjectivation. So Hiroko Kawanami has studied nuns in Myanmar or Burma. She studied nuns who are not legally ordained, so they are not subject to the Guru Dharmas or the Garudhammas in their case, in the Theravada case, but they are still under the monks. So be it through the Garudhammas or through other forms of gender hierarchization, it is a fact that Buddhist nuns are hierarchically under the level of the monks. Hiroko Kawanami has reported from her ethnographic study the voices of some of the Myanmar nuns, so the subjective voice of first-person agents told by the agents themselves in this case. A senior nun, I quote Hiroko Kawanami, a senior nun in her late 40s said it was not until she became a nun that she started to notice actual disadvantages of being a woman. She can now see a laywoman's life beyond the social confines and norms and has come to question many things. Why could she not walk abreast with men or sit level with them or eat before men? Why could she not go anywhere without being chaperoned by a male kin? Why was she expected to do the cooking and not allowed to study like her brothers? She could not understand previously why she was reprimanded if she did not care for her appearance. The endless list of restrictions placed on her had made her exasperated, and she was even convinced that being a woman was the result of her bad karma. The experience of becoming a nun had positive effects on her, as it gave her a chance to look at her previous self in an objective light, and she seems to appreciate her spiritual journey in that way. Another nun said that she, as a schoolgirl, disliked kneeling and prostrating herself in front of monks, but never questioned why she had to act in such a deferential manner. As a nun, she can now understand why she has to pay respect to the Sangha and even appreciates doing the prostration on her own accord. We can, of course, read the hegemony discourse, internalization of hegemony discourse here, hegemony, discourse of patriarchal society, and so on. And this is, however, besides the point. The main point is that this is the internalized subjectivity and the process of subjectivation of these religious agents in history. And so as a nun, this woman can now understand why she has to pay respect to the Sangha and even appreciates doing the prostration on her own accord. So Kawanami says that here it may be useful to refer to the notion of the paradox of subjectivation that has been articulated by Butler and was originally stated by Foucault. This paradox of subjectivation locates agency as a reiterative or rearticulatory practice immanent to power and not a relation of external opposition to power. That is, the very processes and conditions that secure a subject's subordination can also be the very means through which she becomes a self-conscious agent. The agency of self-determination of a nun in this context is formed as she becomes imbued with the communal ethos and strict discipline and undergoes new situations of subordination in the monastic life. and in the process of subjectivation, a nun starts to understand this health, which was previously not possible in early life, and becomes not only aware of what she is, but also starts to assume authority in her monastic vocation. Of course, we don't need to make a judgment on this articulation of this nun's subjectivation, but we need to understand this process in religious historical context. And this is much, much similar to the case of this dual reception of the Guru Dharmas. They are that which subordinates hierarchically the nuns, but as a matter of fact, from a legal and historical perspective, they are also what has enabled the very foundation of the nuns' order, so the very path to liberation trodden as monastics, female monastics, and has even allowed for the re-establishment of the female monastic order in contemporary Theravada tradition. So this is really the paradox of subjectivation, and this paradox can really also make us, I mean, it has made me address some of the cognitive dissonances, as I already mentioned before, that could have arisen in the relationship to this text, in the relationship to the monastic institution. So here we come to the end, and in this slide there is just a recapping of my main points from a theoretical perspective, and of course many of these points, they've also been touched on, and they've also emerged from other lectures in this course. So I will leave these points on the PowerPoint. I only want to bring attention to one of these points. And this main point is the importance of contextualization vis-à-vis essentialization. So contextualization takes the particulars of historical accidents into account and the conditional genesis of religious texts and practices. Essentialization presumes a revealed text from a religious authority, for example the Buddha or the monastic community, as if separated from textual and historical genesis. So this the religious and traditional attitude, of course, has an essentialized perspective to the text, but the contribution of the text's historical and philological method to the traditional understanding of texts lies precisely in the de-essentialization of texts and of religious truth or religious conventions. And this can really also put into question what happens in terms of historical development of the idea, for example, that female birth is inherently problematic rather than contextually problematic, or that not only is inherently or contextually problematic because it is the result of bad karma, and so being born in a condition of non-social advantage and non-social prominence, but there is even a step forward which entails making essentialized statements on the essence or nature of women. So women are weak, women are unable, women are impure, are inherently impure. So this becomes a characteristic of womanhood or femalehood, which is of course a contradiction to the very basic Buddhist teaching of conditionality, since if there was an essence, there would be no possibility for the path to liberation to unfold at all. There would be no possibility of education, of spiritual education and spiritual attainment. So of course this ideology is completely alien to Buddhist soteriology and to the ideology of the Buddhist path. But what I want to conclude with is that the same process of essentialization that the tradition has made throughout its history being divorced from a perception of the dynamics of history, can also be made by modern readership and by uninformed approach to the text, wherein we presume an originally pristine or pure, essentially just or essentially right state of the text, without taking the conditionality level into account. So this is where I want to stop for this. And I don't know if there is time for questions. I think it's already quite late. And perhaps Venerable Analayo would like to wrap things up and wrap this whole course up. And we may leave questions to the forum, or if there is some quick question, I'm still here. Whatever is suitable. I am not aware of any of so Petra Kieferfield's question is: are there any traces of a similar interpretation as in the Vibhasha and the Mula Sarvastivada commentaries? Okay, I have to say the Vibhasha is a Sarvastivada commentary, and in terms of Mula Sarvastivada commentaries, I have to admit this is not a literature that I really frequent in my daily readings. So I have not searched into Chinese and Tibetan commentaries for that. However, given that the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya does know of this very developed module of the Buddha's qualities and of the aspiration to Buddhahood, so the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya has for sure mainstreamed the Indian Bodhisattva path into its own textual classes, I would not be very surprised to find that comparable commentarial glosses would be found in Mula Sarvastivada commentaries, but I don't know offhand. I will try to find if there are. So Petra is writing something. Perhaps we can wait. So it would be interesting to see whether there are different interpretations in the various Mula Sarvastivada commentaries. Yeah, as regards this particular passage, since in the Mula Sarvastivada version, the woman is unable to formulate her aspiration. So as far as theoretical passages in Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya commentaries, which will be commenting on the Mula Sarvastivada parallel, there would be no such a text, since the Mula Sarvastivada parallel only has the Buddha's affirmative statement of the potential of the woman. So there is no actual statement of the woman's aspiration in clear letters. So perhaps there could be something in other places in the Mula Sarvastivada commentaries, but not on this particular passage. But I didn't look at the commentaries of this passage. Okay, Petra is still writing, or is writing again? Okay. Yeah, good to keep the eyes open, indeed. Okay, so we can close here, and thank you for your patience with this extremely long lecture and the whole course.
Good, then it's time to go back.
Okay.
Switch off your mic.